All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, and I have the privilege of being your host this Sunday for our program, the week of the 4th of July. Happy birthday, America. Want everybody out and go to a parade if you get the opportunity. There's going to be plenty of them here in our local area. If you want to actually see what I look like, you may be frightened, but I'll be marching in the Ypsilanti 4th of July parade. It begins at 11 o'clock and goes on down to... Where does it go down to? Anybody help me out here? Okay, Depot Town, that's right. Anyway, it starts off at the EMU Eastern Michigan campus, and we march on down Cross Street down to Depot Town. So 11 o'clock, if you're not doing anything, you're in the Ypsilanti area, I hope you will stop by and see that. Of course, check your local listings in your area for where your parades and where the fireworks are. It's going to be a great opportunity for all of us to celebrate America's birthday. A couple of other events that are coming up. One is really important, and as we understand, you know, the veterans commit suicide at approximately 22 per day, which is just unacceptable, as we've already talked about here before. But one of our favorite local organizations, the Warriors and Caregivers United, is sponsoring a fundraiser and an awareness day coming up on this Saturday, July 7th. At 10 o'clock at the Ann Arbor VA Hospital on Fuller Road. And they're going to be rolling and walking, they call it a walk and roll for the 22. And starting at 10 o'clock, they're going to walk and roll their way up to the University of Michigan campus and back again just to raise awareness for veteran suicide. And we're hoping that you can participate in that. They are looking for people to sign up. It said that they've got a couple of openings available. If you go to their website, let's see, it's WACU.org, and click on events, and then it'll say walk and roll for the 22. And on there's a little site there. It's free. There are going to be refreshments. It'll probably be hot, so make sure you bring plenty of liquid, water especially. And I hope you have a good time with that. I'm hoping that we can get out there and see what's going on. Walk and roll for the 22. That's the Warriors and Caregivers United, a great organization here in the Washtenaw County area to help everybody out if they can. The other big event that's coming up later this summer, which all of you in the local area are well aware of, this is an annual event, but this is going to be Thunder Over Michigan, and Thunder Over Michigan actually has the Thunderbirds. The United States Air Force Thunderbirds Precision Flying Team will be there, and this is going to be on August 25th and 26th. It's always a great show. These professional Air Force pilots, they fly these jets at 400, 500, 600 miles an hour, inches away from each other. If you'd be amazed at the talent and skill that's involved with this. And plus, it's a great show of patriotism to see how these things operate in the air. And there's going to be many, many other. The Yankee Air Museum has a great static display of all kinds of different airplanes and helicopters and jets and everything like that. They've got simulators that you can get in and see if you could actually fly one of these machines. There's so many people out there say, oh, I could do that. Well, get in one of these simulators and see how soon you crash into the earth or actually fly off the edge of the earth. There are going to be some World War II planes there, of course, since it's in Willow Run with the birthplace, the Arsenal for Democracy. So we encourage you to go to their website. That's yankeeairmuseum.org/airshow. And again, that's Thunder Over Michigan, and that takes place on August 25th and 26th. Don't miss it. It's a great show. It's just a great, great show. Oh, and you also have an opportunity to fly, catch rides in some of these aircrafts. So you might want to, again, go to their website, yankeeairmuseum.org, and check it all out for the air show. We've got a great, great program today, and I really want to make sure that you gather all your friends and family, all the veterans that you know, to gather around the radio and listen to this program, because we're going to be talking with a therapist who has been working with soldiers coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan on their bases. It's kind of a new counselor system, and I'll let her describe it when we come back after the break. But her name is Elizabeth Haney, And Elizabeth has written a book called The Honor Was Mine, and she talks about her experiences working with these young soldiers, male and female, and the anxiety that they have either being deployed or coming home from being deployed. Those of you who have done this in your life, go back 50 years for many Vietnam veterans, remember, there weren't any programs available when we came home. And so I think that you're going to find this very helpful for you, especially. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll have Elizabeth Haney on. The book is The Honor Was Mine, A Look Inside the Struggles of Military Veterans. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back. And we're back on Veterans Radio, and your host today is Dale Thronberry, and I have the privilege, and I really mean this, the privilege and the honor after reading her book of having our guest on the program, and that is Elizabeth Haney. And Elizabeth is an MA, LPC, and for some reason she was a therapist in the civilian world, and she decided that she was going to counsel military personnel. I think that was something that you probably didn't anticipate, right? So anyway, I want to welcome to our program Elizabeth Haney. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here, and thanks for the opportunity.
Well, I guess my question to you when I first started reading the book is, why would a therapist on the outside want to get involved with the military?
And to be perfectly honest with you, about a year before I took on this job, I had a colleague that mentioned this work to me, and I thought, oh, no, I would never want to do that. And you know, things happened in that year. I felt a lot of changes, and it was more about logistics. It was not because I had a dedication to the military. I wanted to move from where I was living, and I thought this job will move me around the country. I'll get to see other places. Maybe I'll find someplace I want to live next. I'm just being completely frank with you. It really wasn't about a dedication to the military. When I signed up for the job, I had absolutely no experience with the military whatsoever. My dad was in World War II, but he was not in combat. He was an airplane mechanic stationed in Italy, away from the fighting. And none of my brothers, I have four brothers, none of them served. I have one cousin that was in the Coast Guard, but he lived far away from me. So I had no familiarity with the military at all. So I was walking into a job that I thought, oh, I've been a counselor for 30 years. I can do this. You know, of course. I felt very confident about my counseling skills. But I did not realize that I was walking into a whole different world.
Well, as I mentioned in an email to you earlier in this week, I wish that there had been people like you when many of us came home from Vietnam, because we did not have any counselors available to us. And again, most of us, when we did come home, we went straight home. There wasn't any delay, and we weren't in a group. We went home as individuals. And I think that this, you know, the ability that the military is, what they're attempting to do right now is so much more helpful.
I completely agree. So groups are coming back as a group. They also have a lot of, you know, briefings to do in the week or two that they get back before they're allowed to go on what they call block leave. So they're in a little bit of a container for a while when they first get back. They go on leave, then they all come back together. And really, when I was working on the bases, that was when issues really started to show up, not in those first couple of weeks. But when they got back from leave and really kind of tried to adjust to being back home is when things would get really difficult.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, is this program continuing?
The program is continuing. They place civilian counselors on military bases all over the world. It's not just in the United States. And it's a program through the Department of Defense that has hired this HMO to provide civilian counselors. So I was basically a subcontractor.
Okay. All right.
I worked for the HMO.
Okay. Gotcha. I was trying to figure out, you know, how you got there. We're talking with Elizabeth Haney. Her book is The Honor Was Mine, A Look Inside the Struggles of Military Veterans. And I want you to, if you can, to describe, you did a very good job of disguising, I guess you could say, of where you were and, you know, who you were talking to. There are no, you know, no real names mentioned and so on and so forth. I mean, you did a nice job of explaining that to your readers.
Sure.
But can you kind of describe when you went wherever your first base was, what was your reaction to that? Because you were not there. Most of these bases, you were never there for a long period of time.
I was there usually from 3 to 6 months, anywhere mm-hmm. from 3 to 6 months. So actually that very first assignment, it was originally just a one-month assignment because mm-hmm. the battalion was coming back from combat, and they wanted a bunch of counselors to be available for this battalion that was just coming back. Actually, I think it was a whole brigade was coming back, but I was assigned to a battalion. And by the way, I want to say, I typically refer to the folks I worked with as soldiers, but I work mm-hmm. with people from all different branches of the military. It just gets really confusing to sort of switch the language with, you know, who I'm talking about. So I just use soldiers as a generic term.
Well, that's a good thing, because even those of us in the military, we don't know what the other branches are talking about.
Yeah, well, I use a blanket term. So I was supposed to be there for a month, and then they extended it. I actually ended up being there 3 months. But so I'll tell you two stories come to mind. One of them is the very first morning at that very first base, we're supposed to meet, my colleagues and I, we're supposed to meet at the brigade offices because we have a meeting with one of the brigade commanders that's, you know, going to tell us about the work we're going to do. So we all find the conference room and we show up. We're sitting down 9 o'clock in the morning, and pretty soon this female colonel comes striding into the room. These two guys are walking behind her, and she stands at the podium at the front and she said, "Listen, if you people can't get yourselves here on time, I don't need you in my brigade. So from now on, the expectation," and she went on, and I'm looking at the clock. It's 9 o'clock. We were told to be here at 9 o'clock. We all got there at 9 o'clock. And she started telling us that if we couldn't be there and ready to go 15 minutes early, she didn't need us. And I thought, oh, I mean, I'm someone who's very good at being on time, but I thought, I'm in a different world now. Like, on time is 15 minutes early. I'll tell you, I took that in, and for the rest of the time I work with the military, in fact, to this day, when I go to the VA for a meeting or something, I show up 15 minutes early. I just thought, oh.
Well, that's right.
If
you're early, you're on time. If you're on time, you're late.
That's right. So that was right away. That was within the first few minutes I got kind of slapped down with a bit of reality. You know, I am really in a different world here.
Well, how did that world accept you as a civilian counselor?
They didn't.
Okay.
They didn't. Yeah. Especially this was early on. This was probably, let me see, this was when I first started, was close to 9 years ago. So it was really not too long after the height of the combat in Afghanistan and Iraq. So there was still a lot going on. But, you know, I wasn't a trustable person at all to them. First of all, I'm a civilian,
mm-hmm.
you know, so what do I know? Secondly, I'm female, so they, you know, for the most part, they don't have time for me. And thirdly, I'm a counselor, like I'm going to try to make them talk about things. Like, they really had so little interest in me. And what I learned was I needed to just relax and sort of get in sync with their world. This was completely different than private practice.
Mm-hmm.
I needed to just slow down and really sort of let them get to know me. So every time I started at a new base, I would spend about 6 weeks basically chatting with people in, you know, in the motor pools, in the dining facilities, in the battalion offices, in the, you know, in the work bays. I would just, because I felt like I'm letting them get to know me. I'm letting them check me out mm-hmm. and see if I'm somebody they want to talk to, you know. And that turned out, I mean, frankly, that turned out to be a really, really great way to approach it. I had colleagues that would walk up to them and basically, like, ask them intensive questions right away. And it just wasn't a way to do this work at all.
No, it's very difficult for a soldier, the generic soldier, to talk to a civilian about what they did. because we just don't think that you'd ever understand, you know, what we've been through, or, you know, why we're anxious, or whatever the scenario may be. I can remember talking to a counselor when I first got back from Vietnam, and it was a civilian at the VA hospital, and they were asking questions that I didn't think were necessary, and I just said, well, you know, never mind. I'll take all my stuff with me and go home for about 30 years or so. But so
I hear that kind of story all the time. I really do. Even today, I hear that. I mean, all the folks that I see in my private practice, all the combat veterans I see,
mm-hmm.
originally have tried to get help at the VA or, you know, some organization, and they run into that kind of thing still. Where, you know, one recent combat vet that I started working with, he said, well, I went to the VA, and I said, well, tell me what happened. And he said, you know, there's a guy sitting there that's probably been out of grad school maybe 2 or 3 years. And he said, I get it. He's so earnest. Like, he really wants to help. But, mm-hmm. you know, the second or third question he asked me was, so tell me what happened downrange. and I just thought, oh, my goodness. You know, every veteran I work with walks in the door and says, I'm not going to talk about combat. I'm like, okay, fine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe months down the road we'll start talking about that. But they, you know, they want to make that clear from the beginning, like back off, you know, try to get me to open up about that. Mm-hmm. I respect that. I totally respect that.
Well, can you talk to us a little bit about Sergeant Gallagher?
You know, I have that story right here if you'd like me to read it. I don't know if
A little bit of it. Yeah, sure.
Okay, well, Sergeant Gallagher, I was standing outside one of the barracks with a couple of soldiers, and one of them is very chatty. We've been talking quite a bit. He went inside to get another pack of cigarettes, so I'm left with the second one. And the second one is Sergeant Gallagher, and he's this totally buttoned-up guy. I mean, he is... Literally, I'm standing on the sidewalk next to him, and he's looking around, staring off at the parade field like he's not even talking to me. So I started, you know, I just was chatting. I said, oh, you know, where are you from? And, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he's just giving me one-word answers. So I decide, well, that's not really going to work out. You know, I just don't want to keep tossing him questions. So I just sort of fade out, and I just ask him, you know, hey, you know, what do you do for fun? And, you know, what he does outside of the battalion offices, and he begins to relax. So I'll start reading just a little bit here. Mm-hmm. He talks about playing flag football on the weekends and enjoying fishing in nearby rivers. He tells me about his pit bull mix and his fondness for barbecuing. When he mentions a new F-150 truck, I ask about it, and he launches into a long description of, quote, the beast. The subject matter stays light, and Gallagher seems comfortable, and we end up talking for a good 15 minutes before the other one comes back out saying he got delayed. So I'm thinking we've made a little bit of progress. I make sure to shake his hand before I leave, and I don't know how effectively I've broken through his natural reticence until the next afternoon. Just after lunch, Gallagher walks in and sits down in one of the chairs. Afternoon, ma'am. Afternoon, Gallagher. What's up? Well, if it's okay, I want to talk to you. So I nod. He pulls the chair closer and straightens it so it's at a direct angle to the front of my desk. I think my girlfriend's getting ready to leave me. Gallagher leans forward, puts his elbows on his knees, and clasps his hands together like he's considering a detailed plan or an intricate, a detailed battle plan or an intricate play in a basketball game. His face shows no emotion. But his manner is deeply earnest as he talks about this painful turn of events. As a 68 Whiskey, which is a combat medic, Gallagher tells me he learned not to share too much after 3 deployments downrange. He's dealt with horrific things, friends getting blown up or dying, innocent locals who were hurt, maimed, or killed. He carries all those memories inside him. The voice he uses to describe his work and experiences is flat. He's learned very well how to contain his feelings. Watching him, I realize he doesn't even let himself know the feelings he has. His eyes never leave mine, as if he's trained himself not to let his gaze turn away from anything. Then he says, anyway, nobody needs to know about all that stuff downrange. My girlfriend keeps asking me why I don't talk about my work. She says she wants to know, quote, everything about me. She doesn't need to know that stuff. When I ask him what he can share with her, he looks at me with a blank face. I have no idea, ma'am. So we spend the next hour talking about the kinds of things he might want to share with her. What he did at the office that day, conversations he had, who he ran into in the hallways, things he thought about doing during work, the small things that make up his day. Whenever I give him a suggestion, he says, Roger, and nods his head definitively as if I just coached him on the next move in the basketball game. After the first couple of suggestions, he pulls a pen and a small notebook out of his pocket and begins writing down the list of ideas. Roger, Roger. Gallagher says he'll...
No, I didn't mean to cut you off there. I'm just thinking of the checklist that everybody always wrote down. You know, okay, yeah, I'll do this, exactly. I'll do that, and then everything will be perfect.
Yes, yes. And that was exactly how he was approaching counseling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you
But I have to say, you know, he's a really good example of how, you know, locked away... The folks coming back from combat had to be, and how difficult it was to try to figure out what to open up to their loved ones, how much to open up, what was okay to talk about. Like, they were lost.
Yeah, I agree, because you don't necessarily want to scare your family.
Right.
You know, you want to know everything I did. Well, if I tell you everything I did, you won't think I'm the nice person I was when I left.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
You know, because there's always these stories that I've heard, and even my father was one of these, and I wasn't aware of it, of course, at the time. But my sister would always talk about my dad before he went to World War II, and then the dad that came home after World War II. He wasn't he wasn't the funny dad anymore, and. You know, I thought he was funny. I didn't know the difference. But as I learned more and more, you know, of course, he never talked to me about it at all. But with my own experiences, finding out that, yes, the carefree, you know, kid that you were before you go off to combat is not the same carefree kid that you come home as, because you've seen things that you never imagined in your life that you would ever see. And you talk about one of these things. I mean, you talk about a lot of these things in the book. We're talking with Elizabeth Haney. Her book is The Honor Was Mine. She's a contract therapist who worked with these men and women as they went to battle and they came back from battle. And you talk about, where is that? Oh, separation anxiety. Can you describe that a little bit? We got about 3 minutes before we have to take a break.
Well, separation anxiety, you know, I was working with people who were getting ready to deploy. Sometimes they were leaving in the next week or maybe in the next 24 hours, and they were grappling with what that meant. Like, what was it going to be like to be away from their loved ones? I was working with folks who were mostly deploying for a year. And that's a substantial thing to face, to have, you know, to be gone for a year in these unbelievably difficult situations and not have the support of your wife or your husband or your kids or your parents. Deeply, deeply affecting.
I was thinking about that. You know, you talk a lot later on. You talk about spouses and you know, as we mentioned before, the warriors and caregivers types of things. And I was thinking about that just with my own mom. Is you know, she had already sent her husband off to World War II for 3 years, and then I go off and fight my little war for a year. What was going through her head? And of course, it wasn't a conversation we ever had, unfortunately.
But,
you know, what was she thinking? And, you know, what were her anxieties? And, of course, I was married just before I went to Vietnam. What was going on in my wife's head? What are you doing here? You know, you're going off for a year. You're going to come back. You're not going to come back. You know, how do these things work? And I think that a lot of these things are what veterans in general have to think about and probably have thought about. And because of people like you now, they've got somebody that they can open up to if they want to.
Yes, yes.
Which is always difficult.
They've got people willing to listen if they want to open up, yes, which you did not have.
No, but the idea is here, and I'm not trying to make this all about me. I don't mean to get off on that tangent. But when I was reading a book, it was just every other page I'd say, oh, I know that guy. Oh, I know that story. Oh, I recognize that one. And it was so powerful to me that I can only say that I recommend that it is something that all of our listeners need to read and to just sit down and go through. I think it will explain a lot about behavior. It will explain a lot about the reticence to talk about what may occur and what may not occur, and you know, what they want to share and what they don't want to share. It's such a hard job, and I have to give you all the credit that I have already done, which I'll give you more as we go along, about the idea of sitting down and actually finally getting some of these men and women to talk about their experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And so, anyhow, so we're going to be coming up here on our break. So I'm going to, a couple of things I want to talk about after the break is that the honor and integrity that you discovered while you were talking with these soldiers that you weren't aware of as a civilian coming in. And then we'll talk about your reactions that you had after so many months of talking to these men and women and sort of your secondary post-traumatic stress that you developed on your own.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll let you think about that. We're going to take a little break here for the news, a little Medal of Honor. Then we'll come back. We're talking with Elizabeth Haney. Hey, if you want to get in the conversation, give us a call, 734-822-1600. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back. We're back on Veterans Radio, and our guest today is Elizabeth Haney, and she is a licensed therapist, and she worked as a counselor at various military bases across the country during the ongoing conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, and she was there when they left. She was there when they came back. She's moved around to different bases, and Elizabeth, I played that song purposely. That's Toby Keith, and just to remind people that this is a volunteer army.
Yeah.
These men and women are deployed more than once. In many cases, 3, 4, 5 times, in even more cases than that, it seems. And so we have to remember that, I'll let you tell it. You describe these men and women that you've met over the years.
Well, the truth is I met remarkable men and women, and that was another thing I didn't really understand going into this work. I the caliber of the people that I would meet and work with was astounding to me. I feel like they dedicate themselves to something bigger than themselves. And that's an experience I think most civilians don't have the opportunity to do or don't understand. You know, those folks that sign up to serve are putting themselves on the line, and they're accepting a responsibility and a burden that most of us don't accept and don't shoulder. And I came to deeply respect them for that. It was so moving to me to realize what they were doing in choosing to serve. You know, and whether it's peacetime or war, you know, they're saying, I'm available for what you send me to do.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's, you know, rescuing people from the hurricane in Haiti or going off to combat or, you know, rescue missions somewhere else, you know, it's a whole mix of things. But just that dedication to say, I'm available, I'm actually giving up you know, my day-to-day life, my freedom to come and serve and, you know, serve and protect. It's so deeply moving to me, and I do feel like civilians don't quite understand that. I feel like civilians get caught up in what they think politically about war, or they get caught up in what they think about, you know, combat or these other countries. And they don't really understand just the essence, regardless of all that, just the essence of having these people who step up and say, I will serve.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. And as you pointed out in the book also, you know, the most veterans, most military personnel are not big fans of war. Nobody wants to go to war. There are no organizations out there that says, yay, veterans for war.
Correct.
But, you know, we realize that we have a duty to perform and that we do that duty as long as we can. And then we get out or we stay in, depending on what the scenario happens to be. I was just, during the break, I was looking at you, the prologue about Springer. And this is what got me hooked on the book, folks. If you get the opportunity, really go out and find this. It's The Honor It Was Mine by Elizabeth Haney. That's Haney. And it's on Amazon and probably every place else that you can get them. But can you talk a little bit? We don't necessarily need to read this part because it just breaks me up too much. But talk about him just a little bit, could you?
So Corporal Springer was someone that he had been back from deployment about 6 years. And what had happened was he got, I just got a little bit lost there, but he came in to see me. And he's talking about, you know, he's struggling, PTSD and nightmares and things like that. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue one day, he says, I have to tell you something else. Like, he's told me a lot of things, and he suddenly says, I have to tell you something else. And I said, okay. And he said, well, sometimes I hide in my closet. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, my. And it was like the room just went still, and I just waited for him to say more. And I said, well, okay. I said, well, you feel safer in there. It gets quiet and everything feels safe, right? He said, yeah. And then he looked up at me and he said, but I have to tell you something else. And I said, okay. You know, because I never know what they're going to say. And mm-hmm. he said, he told me about hiding in the closet. So one of his PTSD reactions was he got so dysregulated, what therapists call dysregulated, he would go scramble and go in the closet. He would pull clothes on top of him and basically trying to hide where it's dark and small space and try to feel safe. So he says he was hiding in his closet one day, and he hears his dad out in the house calling his name. But he can't get himself to move, and he can't get himself to respond because he's still so freaked out. And he hears his dad getting closer and closer, and dad walks into the bedroom and calls his name. Springer still can't say anything. And then the dad starts to leave, but at the last minute, he walks over and he opens up the closet door and he looks inside and he sees Springer, you know, kind of curled up in the corner. And he said that his dad just got down on his hands and knees and crawled into the closet with him and took him in his arms. And they both just sat there and cried like babies. And I'll tell you something, Dale. I read that at one of the readings I did here in North Carolina several months ago. It was an audience of about 100 people, and many in the audience had military backgrounds. Two different wives walked up to me at the end and said, that's my story. My husband has done that.
Mm-hmm.
So people think this is such an unusual thing. What, you hide in your closet? Like, what? And two different people came up to me and said, yeah. My husband did that too.
You know, one of the things that I discovered with many of my friends now, my veteran friends, of course, is that when we sit around and we tell our own stories to each other, it makes us realize that we're not that unique, that, mm-hmm. you know, that we're having similar issues with whatever, you know, whatever they might be. And that sometimes that it's very helpful to, you know, the group therapy sessions that sometimes they have at the VA or the ones that we kind of, our unofficial, you know, breakfasts mm-hmm. every once in a while, that, you know, to laugh and to cry and to make people realize, you know, that you're human, you know, you're all right. You got friends and, you know, we're here to help, you know, help you get through whatever it is that you're going through right now. But that, sure. that particular story of the dad getting in the closet with him just really broke my heart. And, you know, Springer also says, you know, before he kind of announces that story, he says, you know, I'm not crazy.
He kept repeating that to me. He kept saying, I'm not crazy, ma'am. And I would say, okay, you're not crazy.
No, you're not. So you had to deal with a lot of these stories just like that.
Just like that. The level of trauma that I was dealing with day in and day out was just almost ungraspable. You know, like I said, I've been a therapist for 30 years. I had, you know, worked with lots and lots of people and people in trauma. But I'd never worked with that kind of just one person after another, after another, after another, with these really horrific stories of trauma.
And how did that affect you?
Well, eventually, you know, what happened was, so small things started happening that now looking back, I sort of added up differently. But, you know, I noticed I was having trouble sleeping at night because I was talking to so many people all day long. I would lay down to go to sleep and my mind would just keep reviewing who I had talked to and what they had told me. And, you know, I don't do that day to day with my counseling practice, but this was so intense that it's like I couldn't turn it off. And, after I finished one of my assignments, I think it was maybe, I don't know, the sixth or seventh assignment, I went to visit a friend and she's chatting with me. We're outside. It's a lovely day and she's talking about something and I realized I couldn't even follow what she was saying. Mm-hmm. And I thought I just have to try harder, and I couldn't. It was like she was speaking Swahili or something. Like, I could not process what she was saying. And within the next couple of days, what I realized was I just was getting more and more and more sort of frantic, and I couldn't really listen to people. And I spoke to a colleague of mine, and she says, do you realize you have secondary PTSD? And I said, no. Said the symptoms are lining up perfectly. You can't sleep. You can't hear anything. You get overstimulated in a half a second. And it opened up for me. Yeah, I tell people I'm glad that I had that experience. It took me. So let me just finish that part of the story. So when she said that, I said, well, I don't know what to do. And she said, well, you know, you want to stay with someone where you feel safe and everything feels, you know, calm and relaxed so your nervous system can quiet down. And she even told me that if I could go out for a run, that would be really good because my nervous system was in fight or flight, so let it run. And so I did several, and of course I got myself into therapy with a very good trauma therapist. But it took about a year and a half to get it to quiet back down. So during that year and a half, I was on edge all the time. I lost things. I'm not someone that loses things. I kept losing keys and the top to this and the bottom half of that. And, you know, I just kept losing things. I was dysregulated all the time. I had a hard time going to the grocery store because I knew it would just get so overstimulated. I would want to leave. And I'll tell you, Dale, the sort of silver lining of all that is that when I continued working with combat veterans, I knew so much more about what they were talking about. And before that, I only knew it from book learning. You know, I knew PTSD from a book.
Right.
But when clients came in after that, the combat veteran clients came in after that, and they would say, I'm really struggling with PTSD in whatever way, the sleep or mostly the anxiety. I could look them dead in the eye and say, I know.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't have it like them, and I understand that. We have a different degree, but at least I understand that neighborhood, you know?
Well, that's the advantage of having somebody like you as a counselor. And we have to take a quick break here. And when we come back, I want to talk about a little bit about the spouses, and especially want to make sure we get into the story about the processing of the belongings, the morgue story, which is uplifting, folks. This is not all downers stuff. This is a very uplifting story. So we're going to take a real quick break, and we'll be right back after this. All right, we're back on Veterans Radio with our guest today is Elizabeth Haney, and she is a licensed therapist and counselor, and sounds like just a wonderful person to get to know. And she has a book entitled The Honor Was Mine, and she's talking about her experiences over about a 10-year time period of going from base to base as troops were going overseas and troops were coming back, and she was there to answer questions. And so one of the questions that you seem to run into fairly often was from the spouses. What's going to happen when my so-and-so gets home?
Yeah, I remember one base I was sent to, and the battalion was mostly deployed to Afghanistan. There was just the rear detachment at the base, but all the spouses were there. And in about 2 weeks, all the soldiers were going to come home. So I was basically on the base with all, at that particular base, it was all wives. There was one male spouse, but at that particular base, it was all wives. And what I noticed was how profoundly anxious they were about who was going to come home. They didn't know how changed their husband was going to be. And so I had one after another, especially young wives. Maybe they had just got married, you know, not too long before their husband deployed, that were coming to my office and sitting down and saying, I want a divorce. And, I mean, it was happening session after session after session. I want a divorce, I want a divorce, I want a divorce. And I realized they're just anxious. Like, they think that's the answer to the anxiety. And I worked really hard to get them to sort of slow down and figure out some ways to cope with the anxiety and, you know, and hopefully help them understand, like, their husband's anxious too. You know, he doesn't know how much you've changed. But that was very striking to me that, you know, the level of anxiety, you know, you think homecoming, oh, it's going to be so wonderful and amazing and it's so warm and wonderful. And really, these women were experiencing levels of anxiety that they just couldn't manage.
No, that's, I can understand that. You know, just the anxiety of coming home, you just don't know what's going to happen. And you don't, you know, because one of the things that you find is that many of your friends, you think they've changed. And then you realize that it's you that has changed. And
that's so true.
And trying to figure out, okay, now how do I fit back into this group of people? And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Before we run out of time, I want to make sure that we talk about your assignment at the, I don't know where, I'm assuming where it is, but I don't know, where you were working at a morgue or a base that had, let me put that back. You were working at a base that handled the remains of the bodies and their belongings.
That's correct. I wasn't actually working in the morgue. I was working in a facility that processed the belongings of soldiers who had been killed or wounded in action. And so it was this really huge building that had little separate areas, and they would clean and catalog and tag every single item that they would get from the footlockers. The service members' footlockers would be delivered to this building, and they would take and they would open it up, and they literally had washing machines in every area. They had all kinds of cleaning materials, and they would clean and fold and beautifully take care of. I mean, I saw them cleaning the bottom of a soldier's boot with Q-tips to get all the dirt off of it. And then after they cleaned it and it was thick and span clean, they would take oil and rub into the bottom of it to make the rubber or whatever it was, look brand new. They would take and wash the shoelaces in the boots, and then they would put them back in the boot, and they would cross them over the same way, you know, one over the other, all the way up the front of the boot. They would take all of their clothing and fold it all to the exact same size and stack it just pristinely back inside the footlocker, which had also been cleaned. They saved a gum wrapper. I was walking by a place and in one of the work areas, and I saw a guy catalog a wrinkled up gum wrapper. And I said, what are you going to do with that? And he said, well, we're going to put it in a Ziploc and send it home. I said, why would you do that? It's a gum wrapper. He said, because we never know. This could mean something to one of, you know, to his wife or his sisters, dad. You know, maybe they always had this kind of gum together. Or maybe one of his buddies gave him this kind of gum to help him stop smoking. Like, we don't make any judgment call. We just make sure the family gets the whole story back. And these people that were working in there, it was a combination of civilian and veterans and active duty. Some of them had waited for years to get a position in that facility because the work meant so much to them. And I say in the book, it was like working in a church, mm-hmm. to work in that environment. They were so pristinely dedicated to the work they were doing and to making sure that the families back home got the belongings back in the most beautiful way they possibly could. And, you know, they're reading the background of the, you know, the soldier that whose belongings they're working on. And you know, they would remember their stories. They would talk about, well, you know, we had one last week. He, you know, he was from a town right next to mine. Or, you know, they had a very personal relationship with the belongings as they processed them. And I was so proud to support those folks.
Can you talk about the one time when you were outside and everybody's sitting around the picnic yeah. tables and so forth? And
yeah, sure. So one day there was a break area out behind the building. There was a little grassy area, had picnic tables, and the entire building would take a break at the same time. So lots of people would go out there and smoke cigarettes or, you know, drink sodas or whatever, hang out at the picnic table. So I'm out there with everybody else because that's a good time to chat with people. And all of a sudden, the entire area goes completely silent. And I look around. I don't understand what's happened. And people start standing up from the picnic table. They don't leave. They're just standing up. And I look around. I still don't understand. And I kind of look quizzically at the woman standing next to me. And she said, "There's a plane coming." And sure enough, right behind that break area was an access to the runway. And there was a very small jet slowly rolling down that access road to get to the top of the runway. And she said, "There's always remains on those jets." Mm-hmm. Every time one of those jets went by, if these folks were outside, they all went completely silent, stood still facing that runway, and honored that service member, that fallen service member, as the jet slowly rolled by. And there's a part in the book where I talk about there was one of the commanders, the facility commanders was outside, and he rushed by me to go back in the building before the plane came by. And one of them told me later it was because he didn't have his hat on. And he thought it was disrespectful to be out there while the remains went by without his hat on. So he chose to go inside instead rather than disrespect that soldier.
It just goes to show you folks, you know, that the real people out there that are, you know, helping our veterans and helping them survive, and even when they don't survive, that they're honoring their memory. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea of folding everything perfectly and even that gum wrapper just broke my heart. And speaking of hearts, you mentioned something about one of your lines was that after your work there, is that your job was catching hearts. Could you talk about that just real briefly?
Yeah, what I was talking about was people would say to me, like, "How can you do this work? Like, how can you work in that kind of intensity?" And I, you know, it's hard to express how meaningful that work is to this day, how meaningful and fulfilling it is for me to work with combat veterans. But while I was on the bases and there was so much happening and so many stories I was tracking and so many people asking for help, and so I wrote the line. That's the best way I had to express it. I said, "I felt like every day I was catching hearts falling through the air." And that image came to me one day where I felt like I'm just reaching out to catch this heart falling. And then right as I catch it, I got to turn quickly another way to catch another one. And then, oh, here comes another one falling. You know, that was a sort of an artistic way of saying, like, that's what that experience felt like. I was catching hearts falling through the air.
Wow. Well, Elizabeth Haney, thank you very, very much for being on Veterans Radio. We've come up again to the top of the hour. It always goes so much faster than I anticipated. you're working with a new organization out there that you mentioned in an email to me. Is it Centerstone?
Centerstone Military Services. So they specifically find counseling and support for combat veterans, and they are linked up with Wounded Warrior Project. So people can either call Centerstone Military Services or Wounded Warrior Project, and they offer services for free. So they'll hook you up with a counselor or a recovery process of some kind, retreats or something, at no charge. So I think it's absolutely wonderful service.
Okay. Well, you know, I think you should have your own radio program and people could just call in and say, here, save my heart, would you please? Help.
Thank you so much.
Well, as I mentioned before, it's a pleasure talking to you. And the book is The Honor Was Mine, Look Inside the Struggles of Military Veterans, Elizabeth Haney, H-E-A-N-E-Y. She's an award-winning author with the Military Writers Society of America, my good friends over there. So they're the ones that turned me on to the book after I said, after I got your email, I said, I heard of this woman somewhere. So, I want to thank you again. Hope to
thank
have you back.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. All right. We're going to, wrap up today's program with a little tune by, Michael J. Martin. Just God bless America. And before we, you know, remember that the 4th of July is coming up on Wednesday. Take a second to breathe on the 4th of July and think about what it really means other than the picnics and fireworks and so on and so forth. We're going to be having some programs coming up over the next couple of weeks. I'm going to take a little R&R for the most of the month of July, and Bob and Jim are going to be doing the programming for me. So until next week, I have to stretch out a little bit. It's okay. I can do that. I know. When we did the military benefits program, send us an email before the last day of the month and we'll get your story on the air. Until next time, you are dismissed.
Oh, beautiful, far spacious skies, far amber waves of grain, for purple mountains' majesty above the fruited plain. America, America, God shed his grace on thee and crown thy good with brotherhood. From sea to shining sea,